I get the joy of introducing our own Robin Proud, who most of you know pretty well by now from her various performances, behind every great man, the Peabody Sisters, and I'll let you go ahead and introduce.
Good morning. I thought I'd introduce our cast of characters a bit first that I have up here. The first hymn was chosen not so much to evoke spring, although we might want to do that, but because the words were written by Ralph Waldo Emerson. In the center here, we do have the three Peabody sisters, Elizabeth, Mary, and Sophia. Now, they were mainly before the age of photography, although this, I'm sure, was taken later in life. It may not be the best likeness of Elizabeth, but it's the only one I could find. Now, it seemed to me that she looked like she was separated at birth from Andy Summers.
So.
If we ever need to cast that part. But she did live to be 90 years old, and I think this was taken later in her life when she was very active in the kindergarten movement. Mary was known as the beauty of the family. I don't know that this picture does her justice either. Sophia was one who actually has her portrait here painted by a famous painter of the time. Then we have some of the other figures. Bronson Alcott, who you probably know as a Unitarian and through his daughter Louisa May Alcott. Horace Mann, who married Mary. And I think that we could cast Galen for this one. William Ellery Channing, very famous Unitarian minister. Theodore Parker, also a Unitarian minister. Nathaniel Hawthorne, I'm sure many of you read The Scarlet Letter in high school with great enjoyment. He and Sophia were married. We do have Emerson down here and Margaret Fuller, who were part of this circle as well. And here, these are smaller, but you can look at these. They did not have wedding photographers at the time, but apparently something they did was to make silhouettes of the couple. So this is a silhouette of Nathaniel Hawthorne and Sophia Peabody on their wedding day, and this is Mary Peabody and Horace Mann on their wedding day. I've entitled my talk, Behind Every Great Man, after a classic saying with that beginning, and it's been filled in different ways. Behind every great man is a great woman, or is a woman pushing and shoving. And supposedly Hubert Humphrey said, behind every great man is a surprised mother-in-law. But it was literally true for many of the major figures of 19th century New England in philosophy, politics, religion, and literature. They worked up and polished their ideas in conjunction with the women in their lives, although we rarely hear about the women. Ralph Waldo Emerson, a champion of self-reliance, had not only his devoted and domestic wife, Lydian, but numerous acolytes who gathered at his home. In descriptions that I've read, Emerson resembles to me a radical professor surrounded by his adoring graduate students. And of these, the most assiduous were women, Margaret Fuller and Elizabeth Peabody. But Emerson wasn't the only one to benefit. The Peabody sisters, Elizabeth, Mary, and Sophia, served as teachers, translators, scribes, discussion partners, promoters, and publishers for a glorious pantheon of writers and artists and public figures. For example, Sophia illustrated stories by Nathaniel Hawthorne. The sisters introduced him into the Transcendentalist circle, and finally Sophia married him. Mary married Horace Mann, and with her sisters, inspired him to devote his life to the improvement of public education, for which he is still famous. He did not have a particular interest in education until he met the Peabody sisters. Elizabeth was an intimate of all these famous folks up here. She never married, and she's best known today for her successful effort to establish public kindergartens in the United States. The sisters all agreed that the highest mission in a woman's life was to help and support great men. In spite of their unquestioned intelligence, industry, and inspiration, these women, in keeping with the culture of their time, never aspired to promote or advance themselves. And here they differed with Margaret Fuller, who was quite willing to be famous in her own right. Most of the information that I'm going to share with you today comes from an excellent book, The Peabody Sisters, Three Women Who Ignited American Romanticism. This was written by Megan Marshall in 2005 and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. It's fascinating, has a lot of detail on their lives and their circle, some photographs and illustrations and a lot of excerpts from their diaries and journals. Ms. Marshall spent almost 20 years discovering and reading hundreds of original documents on the sisters and all the people in their lives. She undertook to read everything that they had written, everything written about them, and many of the books that they would have read as well. Because they interacted with so many famous people, a good amount of their correspondence has been preserved. In fact, sometimes it's possible to see the same event or conversation recounted by various people. The contrast between the more official documents and their personal letters and journals is fascinating. It reminded me of a TV reality show where the participant gets a chance to approach the camera and reveal her innermost feelings about what has just transpired. For example, in writing to the gentleman they admired, the sisters were always formal and circuitous. We would think very vague. But then, in their private moments, in their letters and journals, they sometimes reveal their real passions, fears, and jealousies. I think there's a temptation for us to consider that people who lived in technologically simpler times led lives that were less emotionally complicated. But of course, human beings are the same in all eras. Elizabeth was the one to first befriend both Mann and Hawthorne, to the point that other people thought there was an understanding between them. But then, after each man fixed his interest on one of her younger sisters, Elizabeth denied that she had ever had a romantic interest in them. What I'm going to give you today is just a brief introduction to the sisters' lives, and especially Elizabeth's, and focus on some of the great men that they knew. For further details, I do highly recommend this book, which not only has a great wealth of detail, but also explodes some of the myths that had grown up around them. As I've researched several 19th century women, I've found that after their deaths, their friends and families tended to downplay the radical and powerful aspects of their characters, making them seem more domestic and less threatening to the status quo. To understand the sisters, we need to have at least an acquaintance with their mother, Eliza Palmer Peabody. She was a formidable figure in her own right. A child of the American Revolution, whose father frightened her mother by coming home in war paint and feathers from the Boston Tea Party, Eliza came from an educated and socially established family. But when she married Nathaniel Peabody, the son of an illiterate farmer raised in the backwoods, she doomed herself to a life of financial hardship. Her teaching was often what supported the family and later the work of her daughters. In fact, the Peabody family reminded me of an episode of The Simpsons. It's true, The Simpsons has a reference to everything. In this episode, Lisa is afraid to grow up because she fears she will turn into an adult like her father. Then she finds out that although all the Simpson men are ineffective, immature losers, the Simpson women are uniformly smart, capable, and successful. This was the Peabody family to a T. The three daughters, who had no access to formal higher education, taught themselves or arranged for tutors in languages, philosophy, theology, music, and art. Elizabeth read at least 9 languages and translated numerous works for publication. Sophia was an accomplished artist and sculptor. For most of their lives, the sisters supported their family by their teaching, writing, and small business efforts. On the other hand, their father practiced medicine and dentistry, which at that time did not require university degrees and were not necessarily held in very high esteem. He was never able to establish a successful practice, and he and his sons also failed at several business attempts. The sisters scrimped to send one of their younger brothers, Wellington, to Harvard, where, of course, they could never be admitted. It turned out he spent his time there drinking and gambling and was forced to withdraw. The family sent him off on a whaling ship to learn discipline, but he jumped ship in South America and returned penniless. Another brother, Nat, not only depended on his sisters to help him through business failures and the expenses of an early marriage and family, but then he actively derided the education of women and refused it to his own daughters. So this was the milieu in which these sisters accomplished their amazing endeavors. In the period of 1800 to 1840, the family moved a number of times around the area of Salem, Concord, and Boston, Massachusetts, mainly driven by possible economic opportunities. As young as 16, Elizabeth was already a teacher helping to support her family. The family was always Unitarian, although the sisters sympathized with the efforts of Emerson and Channing to personalize and open up the traditional Unitarian church. In fact, it seems that Elizabeth introduced to those great men some of the concepts which made them famous. So I'm going to talk about several of those men as an introduction to the lives of the sisters. First one is William Ellery Channing. Elizabeth first heard him speak when she was 7 years old. She wrote that she was thrilled as never before to see him communing with God face to face when he was reciting a prayer. His attitude reminded her of her childhood vision of a benignant God, which parents and teachers had tried to replace with a stern Calvinist figure, and Elizabeth never felt comfortable with that. At the age of 13, Elizabeth first had a conversation with Channing, who found her charming and intelligent. And Marshall writes, "If Elizabeth had outlined her past several years' reading, Channing would have been even more astonished. All on her own, and by the age of 13, she had followed a good portion of the course of study he recommended for his graduate students in divinity at Harvard." In 1825, when Elizabeth was 21, she finally had the opportunity to attend weekly service at Channing's Federal Street Church in Boston and to become an intimate of the Channing family. She would often visit on Saturday afternoons to discuss the British Romantic poets. Channing introduced her to Wordsworth and Coleridge, whom she admired. And they also talked about the radical concept that these poets had of God as an idea originating in man. At this time, Elizabeth wrote her own translation. She called it a free paraphrase of the Gospel of John. She interpreted the word was made flesh to mean that truth speaking was a divine gift to man, empowering each individual to search for meaning in life. Channing applauded what he called these original thoughts, although he was not ready himself to take on such a heretical position. And already at this time, Elizabeth used a word she got from Coleridge, transcendental, to describe her philosophy, transcendentalism. During the same time, Elizabeth was holding Saturday morning discussion classes for young ladies. She would share these topics with Reverend Channing at the Saturday midday dinner. And only years later, in reading over her diary of the time, did she see that, quote, "In every instance, the subject of composition I chose for my class on Saturday proved to be the subject of Dr. Channing's sermon the next day." Even at that later date, she never claimed that she had any influence on Channing, only that perhaps she had been a participant in his own self-education. It was Elizabeth who urged Channing to publish some of his sermons. He claimed he didn't have the time or strength to do all the copying. His health was always uncertain. But Elizabeth volunteered to do the work. In fact, she was so good at it, she was able to copy those quickly and accurately while he was reading to her from completely different philosophical works. Elizabeth eventually copied more than 50 of Channing's sermons. And if they were incomplete, she was often able to supply from memory sections that were left out. These sermons were among the first examples of so-called literary sermons. That is, they were closer to personal essays than the tradition of biblical homilies that was more common at the time. Elizabeth had learned from her mother, who was a lifelong teacher, a belief in child-centered education, delivered with kindness and encouragement, leading the children to develop their own understanding. This was in direct contrast to the traditional methods of the time, which relied on rote memorization and liberal use of the stick. Therefore, Elizabeth was very intrigued by the similar educational theories of a neighbor and acquaintance of their family, Bronson Alcott. She called on a number of families in Boston in order to enroll students for his new school, and she then provided the instruction in Latin, arithmetic, and geography, which were some areas where Alcott was weak. Again, she was very satisfied with promoting a great man rather than setting up her own school. Alcott praised Elizabeth as the most magnificent philosophic imagination of any person he ever knew. They opened the Temple School, named for its setting in the Masonic Temple facing Boston Common, in 1834. Elizabeth, who now boarded with the Alcotts, began to record Bronson's dialogues, as he called them, with his students for publication, showing them to another acquaintance, Emerson, who read them, he said, with greatest pleasure. She published this book, Record of a School, in 1835. Once again, she played the role of recorder for a man, which allowed her to promote the book without making herself the center of attention. Elizabeth was so close to Bronson and his wife Abby that when their third daughter was born that year, the younger sister of Anna and Louisa May Alcott, who would one day be famous as Beth in Little Women, was actually named Elizabeth Peabody Alcott. Unfortunately, several incidents interrupted this mutual admiration society. Elizabeth found that she did not always agree with Alcott's practices, such as tempting a child to break rules and then punishing him with isolation. Then there was a new volume, Conversations with Children on the Gospels, over which Alcott wanted more control, and in which he insisted on including his lessons on human sexuality. Although they seemed to us very innocent and vague, at the time this was totally scandalous. Elizabeth tried to persuade him not to distract from his important overall message by shocking the community, but he claimed that that would not be honest. And at the same time, there was a disturbing personal incident. Mrs. Alcott went into Elizabeth's room and read letters from Elizabeth's sister Mary. The letters alluded to Horace Mann, who was another acquaintance, and at that time was an object of affection on the part of both sisters. From what they read, from what Mrs. Alcott read, she accused Elizabeth of criticizing the Alcotts to her friends. This seems like something that would have happened to us during college years. Your roommate came in and read a letter, and someone was saying something about what they told their boyfriend that something. You know. Well, they were still quite young. Elizabeth left the next day. She left the Alcott's home and the school and was replaced by Margaret Fuller. And Abby Alcott crossed out her one-year-old daughter's middle name, transforming her to Elizabeth Sewell Alcott. Interestingly, Elizabeth continued to publicly defend Alcott's educational theories and accomplishments. A few years earlier, as part of her education, Elizabeth had engaged to learn Latin, and through an acquaintance, she had hired his cousin to be her tutor. That tutor was a 19-year-old Ralph Waldo Emerson. At that time, both future transcendentalists were a bit intimidated, and their conversation never strayed from the translations Elizabeth was undertaking. It was through Alcott that Elizabeth re-entered Emerson's circle several years later. In fact, after leaving the Temple School, she went for an extended stay to the home of Waldo, as his friends called him, and his wife Lydia and their infant son, and she made several extended visits of sometimes months at a time. This was a time when Emerson had already resigned from Boston's Second Church in order to pursue a career as an independent writer and speaker. In the summer of 1837, Emerson gave the Phi Beta Kappa oration at Harvard's commencement. In this talk, called The American Scholar, Emerson said to the assembled elites, "I embrace the common." And he praised man's instincts over his education. This wasn't what the elites of Harvard expected to hear. And in 1838, Emerson delivered an even more shocking speech, the Divinity School Address. He advocated a religion too large to be confined to Christianity. In this, he drew on discussions he had had with various intimates, including Elizabeth, and from German writers Elizabeth had introduced him to. Although Elizabeth herself never went so far as to drop Christ from Christianity, she saw him as a great human model for others to follow. But once again, Elizabeth was a promoter and defender of men. She wrote several articles in 1839 defending Emerson, although no one would publish them. It was the inspiration of Emerson as the center of lively discussions that led Elizabeth to a new business venture. She decided to open a bookstore and circulating library, specializing in books and journals from Europe that had inspired transcendentalism. This bookshop would also provide a space for the transcendentalists to meet, and for Margaret Fuller to hold her series of conversations for women, based on the earlier meetings Elizabeth herself had held years before. It was a new venture for a woman to run this kind of business. Reverend Channing had to reassure her that there was, quote, nothing in the business inconsistent with your sex. The idea of selling imported books was also a new one, and the audience was, of course, small. At the same time, Elizabeth was publishing a variety of books herself, as well as the transcendentalist magazine, The Dial. The second sister, Mary, actually spent more years as a teacher than Elizabeth did. She was often overshadowed by her talkative and brilliant sister. Both women were captivated by the romantic figure of the widowed Horace Mann who shared their boarding house in 1832. There was an intense, although barely admitted, rivalry for a number of years, during which Mann seemed perfectly content to have both women as confidants. especially as he continued to feel sorrow at the loss of his young wife. However, he finally settled his preference on Mary. Throughout a long courtship, engagement, and marriage, Mary worked with Mann on his career in politics and education and in the foundation of Antioch College. Many of Horace Mann's principles of education reform, such as eliminating flogging and rote learning, were the very ideals that Mary and Elizabeth had learned from their mother Eliza and practiced with success for years. Mary also wrote a book entitled Christianity in the Kitchen, which was a forerunner of the Boston Cooking School theories that later became famous. The sisters were often defined as having their particular roles, and they even defined themselves that way. Elizabeth was the learned one or the leader. Mary was the beauty of the family, and Sophia was the artist. Sophia was also the invalid. For much of her adult years, she suffered from migraines and other symptoms. Some of these could have been caused by medical practices of the day. For instance, as an infant, Sophia was not docile, and her parents assumed this was the result of teething. Therefore, they dosed her, as was the custom, with calomel, which contains high quantities of mercury and could have severely affected her nervous system. However, it was also true that Sophia's symptoms flared up whenever she felt too many demands were being put upon her or when things were not going her way. In the 19th century, people didn't speak of depression or anxiety disorders, but many families had invalids whose illnesses forced the household to revolve around them. Interestingly, once Sophia had married Hawthorne and left the family home, her health improved markedly. Elizabeth was actually the sister who befriended Nathaniel Hawthorne first. The two families had been neighbors early in their lives, and Elizabeth had communicated to Hawthorne how much she liked his stories. Hawthorne visited Elizabeth for about 6 months while Sophia the invalid remained upstairs in her bedroom. According to Marshall, there was an understanding between Elizabeth and Nathaniel, but once Sophia entered the picture, things changed, and Elizabeth abruptly announced her decision to move away to live with her brother in another town. Elizabeth never changed her opinion of Hawthorne's genius, publishing several of his works, including one illustrated by Sophia. Through the sisters, Hawthorne became so much a part of the transcendentalist community that he planned to start married life with Sophia as members of the cooperative Brook Farm, being started by George Ripley. There were several experiments at this time in communal living. Alcott had had another one. Elizabeth was a big promoter of this and had written very praiseworthy articles in the Dial. The commune had noble goals of allowing members to cultivate the inner worth and depth in the individual soul and to love and assist each other as Jesus would have wished. In reality, Hawthorne found himself shoveling manure and developing blisters from raking hay, which interfered with his writing. And you can imagine, there were a number of people who felt they were very knowledgeable, people with large egos all trying to live together in this commune, most of whom did not know very much about farming. So Hawthorne did not stay with that community, and Sophia did not move there. The communal life may have been especially hard on Hawthorne, since he had grown up almost as much of a recluse as Sophia. He had a very bizarre family life, which may have influenced some of his writings. Instead of living in Brook Farm, the Hawthornes became neighbors of Emerson. Emerson had never really favored the commune idea. He wrote, "Those of us who do not believe in communities believe in neighborhoods." He encouraged his friends and acquaintances to move nearby, which the Hawthornes did. At this time, Elizabeth, deprived of the company of Mann and Hawthorne, turned to a new intellectual companion, a man 6 years younger than she, Reverend Theodore Parker. He was one of the greatest supporters of her bookshop, and he admired her sympathy, her intelligence, and her speech. Unlike Channing, he readily told her that she was a great influence for him, and said, "I shall get several sermons, as I have often done before now, out of Elizabeth's suggestions." As she had done with Channing, Alcott, and Emerson, Elizabeth became a staunch defender of Parker at the time of a controversy over his sermon in 1841, Discourse of the Transient and Permanent in Christianity. Now, I think that Ralph must be channeling Theodore Parker, because next week he's speaking on the transient and the permanent. Parker shocked even the Unitarian ministers by asserting that belief in the literal truth of Christ's miracles was irrelevant to Christian faith. Elizabeth wrote a long article in support of this sermon, saying, If the Unitarian sect had known what it was about, if it had not forgotten entirely the ideas in which it originated, it would have embraced Mr. Parker as its last hope and supported him in his statements. Again, no one would print this article for a whole year. Well, Elizabeth had twice seen the men she admired usurped by her sisters, and within a few years, both Mary and Sophia were to enter happy marriages and have three children apiece. Sophia and Nathaniel were married for 22 years, and she, the invalid, survived him for another 7 years, dying at age 61. Mary lived to be 80 years old, carrying on Horace Mann's work. When he died 18 years into their marriage, he was considerably older. Perhaps Elizabeth was too powerful to be the womanly consort that most 19th century men desired. For example, Emerson, who really enjoyed the company of people like Margaret Fuller and Elizabeth Peabody, married a more domestic type. And I had not realized that before. I noticed she had this unusual name of Lydian. Well, it actually was Lydia, but Emerson thought that was too ordinary, so he changed it. There was an interesting discussion that took place between Elizabeth and Margaret Fuller about the issue of marriage, and this is from Marshall's book. Elizabeth had taken notes on one of Margaret Fuller's conversations, these were the discussion groups, in which the participants grappled with the question of why women failed to produce works of artistic genius. Was it because at the period of life when men gave themselves to such pursuits, most women became mothers? Then what of the women who didn't marry? Why weren't they more productive? The two most accomplished single women present, Peabody and Fuller, sparred over the question. Elizabeth offered the opinion that single women too often spent the rest of their lives in mourning over lost opportunities to marry. Society spoke so uniformly of woman as more respectable for being married that it was long before she entirely despaired. So that sounds as if Elizabeth still hoped or regretted. Fuller snapped back that there came a time, however, when everyone must give up. Well, Margaret Fuller had had the experience of having several men express interest in her, and as things developed, they got frightened, rushed off, and married someone else. The irony, though, is that Margaret, who had given up, found herself married and a mother in a whirlwind love affair in Italy, while Elizabeth remained single all her 90 years. It was through her ability to read German that Elizabeth had learned of the theories of educator Friedrich Froebel. Froebel emphasized developing children's innate curiosity and teaching with kindness and creativity, as Elizabeth had been doing for years. And of course, it was from Germany that the idea of kindergarten originated. Elizabeth was particularly interested in establishing kindergartens in impoverished neighborhoods. She raised funds, traveled and lectured widely, and she even started programs to train the new kindergarten teachers. Mary and Horace supported her, and Mary contributed to her journal, The Kindergarten Messenger. The sisters had always been in favor of abolition and women's rights, and later joined reform groups for women's suffrage and Native American rights. Sometimes their altruism was taken advantage of. For instance, Mary and Elizabeth raised money for a Native American woman who called herself Princess Sarah Winnemucca, supposedly to build schools for her people. But at the end of 6 years, there was little to show for the effort, and the princess was not able to account for the funds. Still, the sisters always maintained their Unitarian belief in the essential goodness of human beings and the perfectibility of society. In summing up, I'm reminded of the saying, Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in high heels. Well, there was some of that going on here, too. The Peabody sisters, without money, position, or university degrees, held their own with and even set the direction for some of the most influential men of their day. Now, we do have time. I'm certainly not an expert on these. This is just an introduction, but I'd be happy to hear from you.